Okay, welcome everyone. This is the office hour session for week 5 of Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory. So, as always with these office hour sessions, if you have a question, just go ahead and type it right into the chat box. Okay, so hang on a second. Hey, buddy. You're making too much noise, okay? I know, but you are, so can you go upstairs and play with those toys? Or else you're going to have to be very quiet, okay? But you can't be dropping the cars. Okay. Just stop talking, please. All right, sorry. Okay, so Lewis says, I've been reading Man, Economy, and State from cover to cover. When will be the next course on this? I'm working on that with Danny right now just to schedule it. It's going to be, so from the time when this course ends, the next one, it will be maybe like, I don't know, a 3 to 5 week gap before we start up the next one, right? Because I am teaching that Krugman course, which is a brand new one that I have to prepare for. So I don't want, you know, the two new courses to start simultaneously. But I also don't want to have too much of a lag for when the second one starts. So anyway, it's at least a few weeks, but not more than a month, let's say, would be the lag for when the second one starts back up. And we'll, of course, let you know. It's just Danny and I have to figure out exactly when the best time to start is. Because this summer, there's tons of stuff going on. Like, I have to go to Mises University and Freedom Fest in Vegas and all that kind of stuff. So we just need to look at the calendar and make sure we're not biting off more than we can chew. But just to say officially, just make sure everyone knows that for sure we're going to have the go through the entire book this calendar year. Okay, so the part of the function of putting the break in would also just be to give you guys a break in case you need to recharge. But we'll definitely go through the whole book this year. Any other questions? Joris de Donder says, talking about Krugman, any news on the debate? Nothing official at this point. I've said to people before, I think the way it would happen, if it ever were to happen, is that, and I do have some more video ideas and, like, you know, funny things to do. I just haven't gotten around to making them yet. I just haven't been busy, but I have some ideas for getting the pledges up. And so that if that ever really took off, I think, you know, such that, like, there was pressure on Krugman to debate me. Because, the whole premise originally was, of course, that if it got off high enough that even his fans would say, why don't you take this punk, you know, and get whatever the number would be, $150,000 for the food bank in New York. Why don't you go debate this guy? And so if it ever did look like maybe he was on the edge considering it, then I think the way it would go through is somebody would, some, you know, producer or promoter rather would secure a location for it and then would, you know, sell tickets. And then tell Krugman, if you come and debate this guy, then I'll give you whatever, $30,000 or whatever the thing would be. So that's the way I would imagine it would happen. I don't think Krugman's going to get on a plane and go debate me somewhere unless he's getting a check. And that's not, of course, the way my thing was structured. My thing is just any donations go right to the food bank. So I couldn't offer him a cut because I wouldn't be allowed to do that. But if somebody else wanted to host the thing and sell tickets and so that person's bringing in money, then maybe he could say to Krugman, I'll give you a share of the ticket take. Any other questions? While you guys are thinking, let me tell you, so this Monday I have an article on Mises.org coming out that explains subjective value theory, and it goes and talks about the Rothbard's example of the guys trading barrels of fish for, a horse. Okay, sorry, my phone's ringing, but I'll just ignore that. Any other questions? Okay, Lewis says, I read the previous one last Monday, so I've been looking forward to the next on subjective value. Right, yeah, so for those of you, in case you just don't know what we're talking about, so at Mises.org, daily articles, last Monday I had one on problems with the cost theory of value, and then this week it's sort of, instead of leaving, you know, the listeners and readers hanging, I'll show you, okay, this is a theory now that can explain prices that is not vulnerable to all the problems of the cost theory that I laid out the prior week. So that's what I've been, while you guys are thinking, you know, if you guys have something else you want to ask, go ahead and I'll wrap this up. Oh, let me just, again, explain the big picture of this. So the reason I like talking about it so much is this is, in my mind, it's just clearly a scientific advance, okay? It's that economists with the subjective theory of value are able to explain prices in a way that is just, in my view, demonstrably superior to the cost or the labor theory of value. Okay, so it's not an ideological thing. It's not that, oh, I don't like the labor theory of value because then that, you know, gives credence to Marxism. So that's not what we're saying here. We're just saying, you know, analytically or just in terms of a neutral scientific approach to the subject of market prices, the cost theory of value was actually pretty limited in its usefulness. That at best, all it could do was explain the long-run relationships between various types of prices for reproducible goods. But if you're talking about, hey, I have an original Picasso painting that I'm going to sell at an auction next week, how does an economist explain the price I'm going to get for it? Well, for that sort of thing, the cost theory is utterly useless, and the labor theory, too, it's useless. And even for reproducible goods, stuff that, you know, that are created day in and day out by producers, the cost of those goods' production doesn't actually explain the day-to-day price that you could get for it. At best, it just explains in the long run how that price would relate to the prices of the inputs. But it, you know, if there was a housing bust, a lot of homes were, you know, the current market price if you had to sell would be less, not only than what it was worth, but if it was a newer house, it'd be less than what you had to pay to build a thing. So anyway, the subjective theory of value, which you saw a taste of already in this course, the examples going through with Smith and Johnson trading fish for horses or a horse, and then adding more people and then building supply and demand schedules and so forth, that, I'm just making sure you guys see the significance of it, is that thing can do whatever the cost theory can and then more. So that's why I'm saying it's unambiguously a better theory, is that if anything the cost theory can explain, the subjective value approach can explain also, but the subjective value approach also explains all those other cases. So when you say, how do you explain the price of a Picasso next week in an auction, you just start listing everybody's rankings, the way Rothbard did with Smith and Johnson. You can do it that way. All right, so now it's true. You might, a critic could say, okay, but where do those subjective rankings come from? And that's, you know, I'm not saying it's the end of the story and that no more work ever needs to be done on it, but my point is because that's it's a more complete theory. Okay. So you always are trying to explain one thing in terms of something else, but at least with the subjective theory, what you're explaining. I think I'm going to sneeze. Hang on. Excuse me. With the subjective value theory, what you're explaining market prices with is the subjective value preferences of everybody else. So that's at least a different concept. It's a more fundamental thing. Whereas the cost theory isn't really doing that. The cost theory is explaining the price of a car by the prices of the materials that went into it. And so you're not really explaining where do prices come from. You're explaining where some prices come from. Okay, so Benjamin Swicky says, can you give an example where total demand to hold would be useful? Yes, I'll give you two. So the first one is well, it's not so much, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. The reason it's useful, there's several reasons, but one thing is when we talk about money, there it's going to be very useful, especially when you're thinking of fiat money, because if you start thinking of a regular supply and demand curve analysis, where there's an upward sloping supply curve, that is a little bit weird to get your head around if you start thinking of, okay, as the purchasing power of money goes up, the quantity supplied of money goes up. That's kind of weird. And whereas, to say that when the price of an automobile goes up, the people selling automobiles try to bring more to market, that makes total sense. But when you say the price of money is its purchasing power. So if you're drawing a regular supply curve and what you're trying to, the market you're looking at is the market for cash, it's just a little bit weird to think as the purchasing power of money goes up, people bring more of it to the market to sell. Okay, so it's just a little bit weird. And so in that framework, at least for me, and I think for a lot of people, it's more natural, it's more intuitive to not think of it like that, to not think of it as some people are trying to sell their money and to try to figure out what way does the price of money have to move so that more people want to sell their money. That's just a little bit weird. It's easier to think, or it's more natural to think, no, there is just a stock of money. There's a certain number of dollar bills out there. And then depending on the purchasing power of it, the demand for people to hold the money changes. And so then the equilibrium is going to occur when the purchasing power of money is such that it equates the total demand to hold dollar bills with the number of dollar bills there happens to be. Okay, so that's why I think it makes more sense for money in particular. And we'll see that once we get to the stuff dealing with money. So I think I'm almost positive we get to that in this class. All right, so you'll see the payoff from going through the total demand to hold analysis with money within the next few weeks. But even more generally, even if you didn't ever deal with the money, I still think it also is useful to go over that total stock, total demand to hold analysis, because it shows, it really drives home the point that modern subjective pricing theory can explain spot prices like right now. So you don't have to have your analysis cover a long time period covering production. The point is you can say right now, how many automobiles are on the used car dealer's lot? What's the stock of cars in existence right now, this afternoon? And then what can we say about the formation of the equilibrium price of these used cars. Okay, and so because if you're doing it the conventional way with upward sloping supply curves, there it's, you know, depending on what time frame you have in mind, to say that if the price of a car is higher, so as you move up that y-axis, you go further out. Hang on, I keep forgetting all the tools we have here. Let me try to show you. Tell me, guys, if this works, because I've never tried this before. All right, so I'm going to try to draw something on this whiteboard. So let's see. Okay, are you guys seeing me draw lines? Okay, great. All right. Okay, so this convention, I mean, obviously I'm not drawing it very well, but this conventional supply and demand chart, and so this is price. Okay, so my point is on a conventional, so here's the supply curve. So my point is if this is supposed to be like the used car market, and then I'm saying, okay, as we go, okay, so now I'm going to do the pointer. So as we go up on the price axis, what does that mean? That means we go, you know, to the right on the supply curve, and so the quantity supplied is going up, the higher the price of the used car. Well, depending on the context, we could mean two different things by that. We might just mean, if it's a very short-term analysis, so we could use this framework to talk about this afternoon, there's a given amount of cars in existence, right? We're not producing more cars today. There is what there is. And then we could use this conventional supply-demand framework to show that the higher the price of the car is this afternoon, the more cars that dealers will be willing to sell at that price, as opposed to just not putting them on the market and holding them back in terms of the reservation demand. Okay, so you can have an upward sloping supply curve even if production is zero. Okay, but what I'm saying is economists also use this framework for longer term analysis. So we can say this is the market for used cars over the course of a year. And then in that case, probably what we mean by saying that as the price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up, we probably have in mind the fact that the producers will actually physically make more cars depending on if the price is high enough. And so that's a really good thing. You know, there's big consumer demand for that particular vehicle. You know, they'll crank out more cars. More cars will shoot out of the factory over the course of the year. All right, so instead of doing that, so that's what I'm saying, there's this ambiguity. So this framework can analyze either case, but especially if you're teaching it to students for the first time, the upward sloping supply curve, they might be thinking that that's just referring to the fact that there's more physical product being produced the higher the prices that the seller can get for it. In contrast, I thought this was an eraser, but it's not erasing. Okay, I can't figure out how to erase it. Let's see. Why isn't that working? Oh, okay. There it goes. All right, and then... Okay, so in contrast, if I draw just this vertical total stock line, and I say that, hey, there's just 100,000 cars, and that's it, regardless of the price, well, then... you know, it's clear that you're really isolating the fact that, no, there's a certain number of cars, and then the market price has got to be what it's got to be in order to get everyone in the community in the aggregate to be willing to hold precisely that many cars, because now the demand, the total demand to hold, doesn't just refer to the, you know, customers who want to buy a car. It also includes the car dealers who want to reserve, you know, the reservation demand, people who start out with some of those cars and want to keep them because the price is too low, that they think, at this price, I'm just going to hang on to my car, I'm not going to sell it for money. Okay, so that's, so just to round out that discussion, my point is the total stock, total demand to hold analysis is great when it comes to money, but more generally, if you're trying to look at a situation that's very short term, where there's not new production coming into the stockpile, where you just have, you're saying, boom, right now, this is how many units physically exist. How do you explain the formation of the market price for this short-term framework? That's when the total stock, total demand and hold analysis is really good. Okay, I saw another question come in. Okay, John Ware says, Mises is quoted in Rothbard's book as saying that if people were mostly equal, that they would not develop any kind of specialization in labor production markets. This seems kind of dumb to me. What do you think he meant? Okay, well, what he means is that the reason, well, you could go the other way. You could say, why is it that we have specialization? And Mises says, because, so again, what specialization meaning? Why is it that some people focus on catching fish and other people focus on hunting wild game and other people focus on picking berries and other people focus on being a doctor and so forth? Why do we do that? Mises says it's because of the higher productivity of labor when we divide up the tasks like that, when we specialize. So everybody, you know, we can produce more total berries and more total fish and more successful surgeries and so forth if we divide the labor up like that. And so then when we do that and trade with each other, everybody can have a higher standard of living, because there's more total stuff to go around per person. Okay, so the question is, why is that the case? Why is labor more productive when we divide up the task of that and specialize? And so then Mises starts going through and, hey buddy. So Mises starts going through and explaining the logic of that, okay? And so one reason is people in different regions of the world might have access to different climates and so forth. Okay, so you say, why should some people specialize in growing oranges and other people specialize in digging up, pumping up oil to the surface and selling barrels of crude oil? Oh, it's because they, you know, some people live in Florida and some people live in Saudi Arabia. So, duh. Of course, we can get more oil and more oranges if the people in Saudi Arabia specialize in crude oil production, the people in Florida specialize in growing oranges. Okay, so Mises says, well, what if that weren't the case? What if everybody's environment were perfectly equal? Well, then that would, you would just knock out one of the obvious reasons why we specialize. Okay? And then another reason people specialize is that they have different aptitudes, right? So to understand why is it that it makes sense and we chop down more wood and we, teach more kindergartners how to read, if real burly guys specialize in going into being lumberjacks in real sensitive, sweet, young ladies specialize in becoming kindergarten teachers. Well, you say, oh, it's because of some, you know, they're just, their aptitudes are naturally suited for those things, right? That the big, gruff, burly guy is just going to make a much better lumberjack than a kindergarten teacher. Okay, and so that's so then you say, but wait a minute, what if there were no such differences? What if everybody came out and, you know, there weren't burly guys and there weren't, you know, real sweet women who were good with little kids? Well, then there would just, you would just knock out another reason that people normally specialize in the real world. Okay, so John's following up here, and he says, is Mises saying that there would be no carpenters, oil producers, doctors, plumbers, real estate speculators if people were equal? Right, that's what he's saying. He's saying that if you took away all the reasons we currently, what he's saying is the reason for specialization right now usually can be attributed to the fact that people are different. Okay, then John's following up and saying, if people can learn, then there will be specialization. Right, but at that point then, so if you say one guy has been a doctor for 30 years and another guy has been a lumberjack for 30 years, and that's why this first guy, he's just, you know, his skills are a lot better, and the other guy at being a doctor, and the other guy's just much better at cutting down trees, well, at that point they're not equal. All right, so I would have, I mean, if you want to go dig up the quote and reproduce it, then that's, you know, then we can see was Mises clear about that. But I mean, let me put it this way: for him to be right, he has to mean more than just people are born equal. It has to be the case that they also can't develop proficiencies by focusing on one thing or the other. Because then you're right. Even if everyone came out of the womb totally equal, if one person went into studying medicine and the other person went into studying engineering, then it would make sense to specialize. But if Mises is saying, you know, the stronger point that, well, no, even then, you know, you just ruled out my hypothesis that they wouldn't be equal at that point anymore, then that's the way you'd salvage his point. Even, I should point out, even if under that stronger condition, you still could have some type of specialization and cooperation, because there would be tasks where, like, I'm trying to think of an example. Just, there's lots of tasks where people can boost the productivity of something by cooperating, even if they're identical and interchangeable, right? So if I think the example I gave in the lecture the other day, like if we're trying to get knock down coconuts from a tree, you know, and you've got a tree in your backyard and I've got a tree in my backyard, and we could just remain isolated and knock down our own coconuts, or we could help each other, and, you know, you stand on my shoulders and knock down the coconuts, and then we go across and do the same thing at your house, and we more than double our output. And so then it would make sense for us to cooperate like that. So, you know, that could work, but I guess the point would be, even there, if we truly were interchangeable and it wasn't like one of us was heavier than the other one, then there'd be no reason that I would always be the guy standing on your shoulders or vice versa. Right, that it would, so yeah, we could come together and cooperate, but there would be no reason for specialization. Okay, buddy, you can't do that. All right, so like I say, John, so you're right. I don't remember the exact quote he put in Rothbard's book, but yeah, if you go read it in Human Action, it does look like he's leaving, that he's not plugging the gap in the analysis. It does look like, if you go read it there, that what he's saying is, if we had, you know, people are equal in terms of their genetics and stuff like that, in terms of the physical environment, then there wouldn't be specialization. And I don't think he specifically, you know, dots all the I's and crosses all the T's by saying, and they can't even be allowed to become different through their experiences. Okay, so it's kind of a long roundabout way of making the point, because you just have to really, you know, it's not just a little thing like, oh, people all went to the same school or something. I mean, no, he's really, to get his point to be true, he really has to change the nature of the universe and say that people can't even become different through their life experiences. So, but again, I mean, it's, I think the reason they stress that is because, you know, a big challenge to free market economics has always been this notion of equality. Okay, so a lot of the egalitarian, sorry, a second.
Hey, buddy. Sorry. Buddy, you please go in a different room, okay? You're being too loud. Okay, but buddy, if I have to ask you one more time, then you gotta leave, okay? Okay, so be quiet.
Okay, so they have to, so the egalitarians, the people who champion equality, they were one of the biggest opponents of free market capitalism, and so that's, I think, partly explaining why Mises is making this point, which you might say, you know, what's the point of making this claim that you have to back up with so many ridiculous caveats and so forth? Like, why even say that? Why not just say, oh, the reason we have specialization is because of X, Y, and Z? And I think it's because of the rhetorical effect, like to show it's good that people are different, right? So we should stop striving for equality that actually modern life depends on the fact that it thrives on the fact that we're all different, and some of us are better at doing some things than others, and in fact, that's what makes us very rich. And so that's, I think that's why they stress that point. Okay, other questions? What are you guys thinking of other questions? I'm going to try to clear this whiteboard. Okay, Benjamin Swicky says, QE2 ends next month. How much difference will there be between stock and flow versus expansion of the Fed's balance sheet relating to support of the economy? Okay, and then Hamang Tana asked a different question. Benjamin, let me answer Hamang's first because his is following up some of the previous thing. I'll come back to yours. Okay, so Hamang says, can the demand to hold analysis also be useful in the stock and commodities markets? Yeah, that's a good point, Hamang. It's definitely good in the stock market. Okay, hang on a second.
Hey, buddy. You're just being too loud, okay? Please go upstairs. Okay, I know you're not trying to be loud, but I'm here. I'm almost done.
Okay, so you're right, Hamang. That's a good one. The stock markets are, so like if there's a particular corporate stock and they're not making more shares, right? They're not splitting shares or issuing more stock, then that would be a great market to use the total stock literally and total demand to hold analysis for. The commodities markets there, I mean, I don't think that's more or less useful than something else. I mean, because it's, if you're talking about copper or whatever, or you know, soybeans or something, there the people do produce more of it, and so that would be the same thing as like the used car market. But yeah, it's something like the market for corporate stock. Definitely, that's something where on any given day, or even a week or whatever, you can imagine there's just a certain amount of that stuff to go around, and the price has to be such that everyone wants to hold collectively the total number of units. Okay, so back to Benjamin's question. So I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to give you the answer or to answer exactly what you want, but let me just explain the issues. So the program of quantitative easing, the second round of quantitative easing, where they were going to buy, what was it, $600 billion, I believe, of more treasuries that they formally announced last November, that's supposed to end next month, right? So they will have gone through all those purchases. And so there's a dispute. Some people are saying, I think like Jim Rogers, I believe he's one of the people saying this, is that, not Bill Rogers, excuse me, Bill Gross, the guy from PIMCO. I'm pretty sure he's saying that he's getting out of treasuries because he's worried that, look, when the Fed, so right now, what does that mean, the QE2? It means since November when they started doing this program, every month the Federal Reserve has been buying many billions of dollars worth of treasuries, right? So the Fed is effectively creating money out of thin air and then using it to add U.S. treasuries to its balance sheet. And it's been doing that, you know, like $70, $75 billion a month, something like that. So the issue is, so what does that mean? When you buy a bond, you push up its price and you push down the interest rate, the yield on the bond. Okay, so another way to see it is to say effectively the Fed is like lending money to the government, and since they're coming into the market as an extra lender, that's going to push down the interest rate. It's like the supply of loanable funds has gone up. Okay, so the idea is, okay, now if the Fed stops doing that in June, you know, now this string of whatever it was, $75 billion a month of extra purchases of treasuries, that's going to cut off now. And so I'm pretty sure it's Bill Gross and others are worried and saying, wait a minute, if now this humongous buyer of treasuries drops out of the market, won't that make the price of bonds go down and won't that make interest rates go up? Okay, so if you're holding bonds and you saw that coming, you would want to get out of it, right? You don't want to be holding a bunch of bonds when their price drops and interest rates go up, because that's a capital loss. You know, the value of your asset goes down in that scenario. So so that's why a lot of these big players in the bond market are worried about the end of QE2, and some of them are reducing their bond holdings because of that, thinking that once the Fed drops out, that's it. Okay, so now in response, a lot of economists like Paul Krugman and others are saying, no, that's a very superficial analysis. It doesn't matter what the flow of bond purchases is. So it doesn't matter that, you know, in order for the Fed to keep interest rates low, it's not that the Fed has to continually keep adding more and more bonds to its balance sheet. You're saying, no, the important thing is just how many bonds are on its balance sheet right now or, you know, at any time. So they're saying it's a matter of the stock of bond holdings, not the flow. And they're saying that since the Fed is not, you know, they're not selling the bonds, they're not dumping them, they're still keeping them off the market, they're still holding them, it's just they're not adding more to their stockpile. And so they're saying the effect of doing that is the same. So as far as, you know, where do I stand on that, it's hard to say. I mean, if you really push rational expectations and you think that people are, you know, prices are supposed to adjust pretty quickly and people aren't stupid and that sort of thing, you would, in a sense, I mean, the allegedly beneficial effects of the quantitative easing program should actually have kicked in, not even when the program started, but when it was first announced, or when people first, you know, got a hint that it was coming, which was like back in August of 2010. It was in August of 2010 that Fed officials were, not in so many words, but letting people believe that there was another round of quantitative easing coming. And in fact, the proponents of QE2, that's what they point to. They'll say, if you look at the stock market, if you look at some other indicators, it does look like things turned around in August rather than in November. And so they would say yes, because people are rational and they knew, you know, the effects of QE2 kicked in when people knew it was coming, not when the Fed actually goes out and you know, does the transactions. What matters is that people know it's coming and then they adjust. So if that's true, then it would be kind of weird to think that when the program ends, when everybody saw it coming, that would change something. Okay, and there's another argument too that, look, if how can it be that when the Fed stops buying bonds next month, that all of a sudden bond prices are going to collapse and interest rates are going to go up? Because if that were true, then like 2 weeks before the Fed stops buying bonds, people should see that event coming and they should start selling their bonds early to try to get out before the crash happens. But then that means the crash would just happen 2 weeks earlier. And then you say, well, then why wouldn't it happen 4 weeks earlier and 6 weeks earlier and so on, okay? So there is that element to all this stuff, but I think the problem is that type of argument where you say, no, there can't possibly be a crash at this point in the future and we can't possibly know it's coming, because if we all did know that, then it would happen the week earlier, and then a week earlier, know that it happened today. I think the flaw in that logic is you're assuming everybody agrees with you. And that's precisely what's happening right here, is that people don't agree with each other. Bill Gross and others are saying bond prices are going to go down, yields are going to go up when the Fed stops making those purchases next month. And other people are saying, no, you're wrong, we disagree. Okay, so when you try to say, well, why isn't the price crashing right now? You could say, because not everybody agrees. And you say, well, then why aren't some people getting out now? Well, they are. Bill Gross and others are reducing their bond holdings because they think there's going to be a collapse in the price. Okay, so I think you can be a little bit too cute with the rational expectation stuff, and the specific error is in assuming that everybody has the same view. Okay, because again, that's precisely what we're arguing about. We're trying to determine our bond price is going to collapse next month. So if you're asking me, Benjamin, I mean, I guess I would be, I fall somewhere in the middle, that I do think the Fed has been supporting bond prices and thus suppressing interest rates with its continued purchases, and that once it gets out of the market, that will have an effect. But on the other hand, I do think the market has already priced in at least some of that effect. So it's not going to be, because, how can I put it, clearly it makes a difference if the Fed were to have announced we're going to buy $600 billion of bonds, or to say we're going to buy $6 trillion, right? I mean, so nobody's denying that. The issue is just, when would you have seen the impact of that? Okay, because if you thought markets were really totally rational and everything adjusts automatically in 2 seconds, if the Fed had announced we're going to buy $6 trillion of stuff back in November, then the market should have just adjusted and everything. You know, and they said we're going to buy this much, you know, $600 billion per month, let's say. The market would have totally adjusted to that, and then things just would have played out normally. as long as the Fed did what it told everyone was going to do, and then when it stopped those purchases, that wouldn't have caused a massive shift on that day, because everyone would have seen that coming for 6 months. Okay, and so the price trajectories and everything would have just smoothly gone into that. And so it's the same kind of thing here, that when the Fed stopped with these purchases, you wouldn't expect interest rates to just shoot up right away, because people knew all along when the Fed was going to make these purchases and when they were going to stop. So the idea is, initially, interest rates wouldn't have gone down as much, knowing that the Fed was ultimately going to stop, right? So if instead of stopping next month, if the original QE thing meant the Fed was going to keep buying $75 billion of bonds until the year 2020, I think a lot of people are thinking, oh, so that means interest rates wouldn't shoot back up next month when the Fed stops, because it'll keep knocking them down. But it's not really like that. It's more that, no, interest rates would have been pushed down even more. Okay, so anyway, what I'm saying is, it's, I think you will see a little bit of a push up, but I don't think it's going to be this huge change on the day, just because, again, people see it coming, and already people are getting out, and so you already are going to see interest rates right now are higher, precisely because some people are already jumping ship. Okay. Now, having said all of that stuff, the other thing too is, though, that people don't know. Again, the future is very uncertain, right? So we don't know what the Fed is going to do, and so I think a lot of people are wondering, is it going to be QE3, and so forth. All right, so it's so again, these are just all reasons to say, I do think there is this issue of the flow, that if the Fed does stop, interest rates are going to go up, and then they might rise higher and higher if the Fed stays out of the market. But part of that, it's not that the rational expectations logic is wrong, it's that it's wrong to assume we know what the Fed's doing right now. So in other words, people right now aren't sure what the Fed's going to do in September of this year. The Fed might be buying another $75 billion of bonds, or it might buy nothing. And so as we get out of QE2, and now we're in uncharted territory, every month that goes by and the Fed doesn't buy any more bonds, you could expect interest rates to go up a little bit, because people are, the market's saying, okay, we weren't sure. We thought maybe they were going to buy bonds, but they're not now. And so, originally when we were pricing in long-term interest rates, we had thought there was a small chance the Fed might come back in, because, the economy's still weak after the end of QE2, and they would start QE3. So every month that goes by after QE2 is done and the Fed has not yet started up QE3, the market's going to say, oh, the Fed's being tighter than we thought, or that we thought it might, and so now we're going to revise our expectations, and interest rates are going to be a little bit higher. Okay, so you might see in practice interest rates ratcheting up the longer the Fed, keeps its hands off and doesn't do anything else, but that doesn't really refute the people who are criticizing the flow model. It's just showing that we're not sure what the stock of Fed bond holdings is going to be next September or next October. And every month that goes by where the Fed doesn't buy more gives us more information about what the stock is going to be at that future month, right? So, sorry, if you got lost there, some of you, don't worry, that was kind of an esoteric thing, but I'm just trying to show you that with economics and financial markets, it's really hard to think through this stuff systematically, because there's so much uncertainty. And when you try to pin something down and make a logical point, a lot of times you're building stuff into the assumption, into your little model, that you won't realize is sneaking in the back door, and you end up concluding something that's wrong. Okay. John Ware says, can you give a concise definition of a priori? Sure. So a priori means something that you know without reference to experience. Okay, so you can know it just by thinking about it. You don't have to go out and see the real world in order to know that the thing is true. So that's what a priori means. Then John says, it's an ambiguous term that should be replaced with something that's more descriptively precise. Do you have a suggestion? Well, it's not really that it's ambiguous. I think it's just that it's odd. Like, we don't use it in normal, everyday English. But, I mean, it's a very precise term. It's just, it's used in, like, Kantian philosophy. It's not something that you use in everyday life, so it seems ambiguous to us, but it actually means something fairly precise. The reason they use it, obviously, is because Mises used it a lot, and they use it because it is such a precise term. Like, if you are going to philosophy, at least a certain field of it, of epistemology, how do we know stuff? I mean, those terms have a long treatment. Okay, so Mises didn't invent the term. I think that it was something that Immanuel Kant talked about and others in terms of how do we know stuff, right? So that's like something called a posteriori, which means you know it because because you've looked out at the world. The mnemonic that you can use is just think a priori has the word prior in there. So it's like you can know something prior to going out and investigating. All right, so it's not a priori to say the sun is warm. Okay, because you can imagine the sun not being warm. All right, so how do I know the sun is warm, but how do I know that? Well, because sunlight's warm and everything we know about science suggests what a star is and it must be very hot and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I'm very confident I know that the sun is warm, but I don't know that because of a priori theorizing or introspection. Whereas when I say that a person will choose, if a person's presented a choice between two objects, two goods, he'll choose the one that's highest on his value scale, or that's higher on his value scale, I can know that a priori, right? I don't have to go out and run the experiment 3,000 times and see when people are presented with a choice of two goods, they pick the one that they prefer more than the other. You don't have to test that because this, once you understand what those terms mean, you know that, oh yeah, of course a person picks the more preferred good. That's what it means to be more preferred. Okay, so that is something I can know a priori. All right. John had dug up the quote about the division of labor, so let's see what this says. So this is from Mises. One may as well consider these two facts as one and the same fact, namely, the manifoldness of nature, which makes the universe a complex of infinite varieties. If the Earth's surface were such that the physical conditions of production were the same at every point, and if one man were equal to all other men, division of labor would not offer any advantages for acting man. Right, so I think, so there, to me, that sounds like he means right now, this snapshot in time, if people are all equal, there's no reason to have a division of labor. And so I think there he is including the fact that they can't be different because of their experiences. He's saying, no, right now, if the Earth's surface, you know, producing oranges were equally advantageous everywhere and digging up crude oil were the same everywhere and everybody were equal, well, then there'd be no reason for the division of labor. And so if you try to call him and say, well, no, but what if from birth, this guy was trained to be a pianist and this guy was trained to play the violin, wouldn't they be, you know, different? And he would say, yeah, they'd be different, but then you'd be violating my assumption. I said, if everybody were equal. And in your counterexample, this guy is really good at playing the piano and this guy's really good at playing the violin, so they're different. That's not what I was talking about. So I think that's what he would say. Okay, Helgard Muller says, What is the Austrian take on currency valuations? Since it is related to the current question, in my own country, South Africa, there's a lot of talk, especially last year, that our Reserve Bank must try and weaken the currency because it was getting too strong. One of the reasons given for this was the U.S. Fed's quantitative easing programs and all the investment money that was flowing into the developing country like South Africa as a result. Our labor unions and exporters have been asking for this too for a while now. As far as I know, our central bank did try and weaken the currency, but it was argued it was not very successful and ultimately very expensive. We did not try a Tobin tax. Okay, and this will probably be the last question here. We only got a few minutes left. I think most Austrians would say the ideal situation would be if governments weren't involved in money and banking at all. Okay, so you'd have money would be developed in the private sector. You'd have the private companies that would take gold and silver and mint them into coins. You'd have private banks that would, people would come and deposit their commodity money there, and then the bank would give you like a checking account deposit and, you know, give you those things. You could write checks, give you debit cards, and then, you know, give you notes, bank notes, so pieces of paper that a reputable bank would issue, like, you know, a Citibank 5-ounce gold note, paper note. So you go to a merchant and give them the paper note, and the merchant can recognize, oh, yeah, this thing is legitimate. This is printed by Citibank, and I'm going to accept this and sell you my goods because I know when I go turn in this piece of paper to Citibank, they're going to give me 5 ounces of gold. Okay? And that's, now, in the Austrians, we have a fight with each other about could those private banks be fractional reserve or 100% reserve, but that's, you know, that's a minor dispute in the broader agreement of the government should not be involved with money and banking at all. Okay, now, what if you're going to say, okay, but in the real world right now, governments do have currencies. We don't have a totally free market. What should be the policy there? Well, then the next best thing, probably most modern Austrians would say is, okay, if the government does have to be involved in producing a monopoly paper note, so that, you know, private banks can't issue their own paper currencies, but it's just there's one paper currency per country, well, then it should be tied to gold or to silver. And then all the currencies of the world would have fixed exchange rates with respect to each other, right? So if the dollar is tied to gold and the euro is tied to gold and the South African rand is tied to gold, then the dollar-rand exchange rate would just be a multiplication problem. You would say, how many ounces of gold does the dollar trade for? How many ounces does the rand trade for? And then you would just figure out, well, the dollar to rand must be such and such, otherwise there'd be arbitrage opportunities. Okay, so what Helgard is talking about, though, is now when we have fiat currencies, what happens is the Fed comes in, blasts in a bunch of new dollars into the financial sector, and then what happens? Well, it pushes down interest rates in the United States. That's, you know, that's part of the goal. And so now there's some other countries like South Africa. This is also was true in Brazil. Their interest rates were higher. And so a lot of investors were trying to get out of dollars and into the financial assets in South Africa and Brazil and some other countries. And so what was happening is you had a lot of inflationary pressure in those countries because of, in a sense, all this capital that was trying to flow into it. And so that was tending to push up prices. So now, if you just had freely floating exchange rates, the way that would fix itself automatically is that the dollar would fall against those currencies, against the rand or against the what is it? Is it Brazil? Is it the Real? I think so, but I could be wrong. Okay, so that's the way it would normally happen, is that the dollar would just depreciate sharply against those currencies, and then you wouldn't, you know, the dollar wouldn't be pushing up prices in South Africa or in Brazil, because, yeah, you have a lot more dollars flowing in terms of investment, but it's much weaker. And so that, like, it, you know, it counterbalances it. You have twice as many dollars flowing in, but if the dollar's half as strong, it's the same amount of real pressure on domestic prices in those countries. But the central banks and the governments of those countries don't want that to happen. They didn't want to let their own currencies strengthen against the dollar, because then that hurts their exports. Right, so when their exporters are trying to sell stuff to the United States, the exchange rate matters. If the dollar weakens, then that means, you know, if you're someone trying to sell something that's $1,000, I'm saying it right, it's a rand. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Yeah, I hope so. So if you're a producer in South Africa and you're trying to sell something that costs 1,000 rand to a U.S. consumer, and then all of a sudden the dollar falls in half against the rand, well, now that 1,000 rand item to people in the U.S. costs twice as many dollars, because the dollar is half as strong against the rand. So from the U.S. consumer's perspective, all of a sudden the price of everything in South Africa doubled when the dollar falls 50%. Okay, so they wouldn't buy as much. So if you're an exporter in South Africa and your currency strengthens, your sales go down. So you're mad. All right. So politically, a lot of governments don't want, and central banks, they don't want their currency to strengthen too sharply against other currencies, because then that hurts the export sector. And a lot of times, you know, those companies are pretty strong politically. It helps. Consumers, because it keeps prices down, because now they can import stuff from the United States on much better terms. Okay, so that's what happens when the U.S. is doing the quantitative easing and debasing the dollar and basically flooding the world with dollars. It puts all of these other countries in an awkward position where they have to either allow their currency to appreciate, which is going to get their export sector mad, or they keep the exchange rate where it is and they allow all this investment to come in with, you know, strong dollars that then causes all kinds of inflationary pressure, raises prices and hurts their own consumers, and it also can, you know, set up male investments and so forth. Okay, so yeah, Telgar, to answer your question, I think what happens is, think of it like this. The dollar is the dollar in the United States. And we know if the Fed comes in, pushes down interest rates, and floods the U.S. with a bunch of dollars, that will cause male investments and cause a boom-bust cycle. Now, South Africa does not use the dollar. So it could inoculate itself against a lot of the boom-bust male investments if it sort of repelled those extra dollars or neutered them. So now you have all this massive flood of dollars that's rushing towards South Africa. One way that South Africa can sort of protect itself is by having the dollar very quickly fall against the rand. So now that flood of new dollars coming in isn't as distortionary because they're much weaker. Okay? But because they don't want to do that, because they're going to intervene and keep the rand, suppress the rand from becoming too strong, it causes the problem. One way to think about it, and I got to stop because we're over time. One way to think about it, Helgar, is how is it that a central bank keeps its currency from appreciating against the dollar? Well, what they might do is they might just print up more of their own currency, right? So, and I don't know what exactly South Africa did, but like, I think this is what China did for a while, is when the U.S. was inflating and China didn't want the yuan to appreciate, the Chinese central bank printed up more yuan. And that's the way they kept, the exchange rate the same. So what's happening is if the U.S. is inflating like crazy, creating a bunch of dollars, and then other central banks don't want to see their exchange rate move too much, it forces them to inflate their own currencies as well. So the reason you can get a boom-bust cycle in those other countries is largely that they are, their own central bank is flooding their own country with the domestic currency, but it's a little bit, you know, it's not totally their own fault because Bernanke is putting them in an awkward position. Bernanke is basically saying, you have to inflate your own currency or else I'm going to wreck your export sector for a while. Okay, so that's the way I would handle that. Okay. All right, thanks everybody, and I'll see you guys on Wednesday. Remember to do your quizzes.